Black Lives Matter community. White supremacists on the mall, chaos. Where do we go from here? Chaos, challenging the legitimacy of democracy, or Black Lives Matter community, trying to forge connection between all concerned citizens to radically reorient the government back to its original purposes as articulated by the founding fathers. Chaos, white supremacy, community, love of all peoples. That's how we make a start.
That's Michael Eric Dyson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Michael Eric Dyson on chaos or community. In his 1967 book, Where Do We Go From Here?, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote these prophetic words: "A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. The oceans of history are made turbulent by the ever-rising tides of hate. We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. This may well be, Dr. King says, our last chance to choose between chaos or community." More than five decades later, the chaos is all too apparent. A raging pandemic with its mounting death toll, acute economic distress, a climate in peril, and the fury of the January 6th insurrection and all that was behind it. We are at a proverbial crossroads. What will it be, as Dr. King asks, chaos or community? Our guest today is Michael Eric Dyson. He's an internationally renowned scholar of race, religion, and contemporary culture, and is Centennial Chair and University Distinguished Professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. Among his many books are April 4th, 1968, Holler If You Hear Me, Searching for Tupac Shakur, and Jay-Z, Made in America. This online event was hosted by the University of Colorado at Boulder and Metropolitan State University in Denver on January 22nd. And now, Michael Eric Dyson.
When I think about the legacy of Dr. King, born in 1929, died in 1968, 39 years old, didn't reach 40, in the process of his life, in the process of his career, in the process of his activism, he certainly was committed to notions of racial justice, of nonviolent, non-cooperation with a system of evil, non-cooperation with injustice, which is why he said injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so when we look at Dr. King's legacy and ask, well, what is its relevance to what's going on now? We can turn to his most noteworthy speech. That is the I Have a Dream speech in 1963, August 28th, to mark the eighth anniversary of the death of Emmett Till. And as you all will remember, Emmett Till was the young 14-year-old boy traveling from Chicago down to Mississippi, supposedly whistled at a white woman, was abducted from his uncle's home in Mississippi, taken, shot, beaten, had a 70-pound cotton gin tied around his neck and tossed into the Tallahatchie River. And when they recovered him, his mother refused to have a closed casket funeral because his face was so hideously disfigured. She wanted the world to see the impact of racial hatred on the body of Black people. And so there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there was no Instagram, but there was Jet Magazine, and the circulation of that idea, the circulation of that picture really changed the game and motivated people all over the world, like George Floyd's death did. And in this case, Rosa Parks remembering the death of Emmett Till, stayed on that bus in Montgomery, Alabama, 1955, and then determined that she would no longer cooperate with the mandate for segregated busing, Black people in the back, white folk in the front. And so when I think about Dr. King's speech, and of course, there's a peril in only focusing on the I Have a Dream speech. It would be like, you know, your favorite singer or rapper or performer or artist, and all you focus on is one song. Could be their greatest hit, but if they've had other songs, Stevie Wonder, Jay-Z, Beyonce, Taylor Swift, Kodak Black maybe. So just got out of jail, or at least pardoned from the former president, along with Lil Wayne. So Dr. King had more than one speech. We know his I Have a Dream speech, but the speech he gave before he died, the night before he died, was arguably an even deeper dive into the history of American resistance to social justice and the encouragement of America to embrace the movement for the radical redistribution of wealth, for anti-capitalist beliefs, to combat anti-Blackness, to put forward his anti-racist agenda, and to talk about class inequality in America. But in that I Have a Dream speech in 1963, besides the I Have a Dream part that everybody knows about, I have a dream one day my four little children will live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, right? Everybody knows that. Or they know down in Alabama with its vicious racist governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. Right there in Alabama, little Black boys and Black girls will join hands with little white boys and white girls and sing together as sisters and brothers. I have a dream, right? So, wow. But in that speech too, he had some other things. He starts off by saying 50 years ago, what do we all immediately think of? Y'all are historians, right? I'm glad you said so, Abraham Lincoln. 50 years ago, you know, in his great speech, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Then he goes on, this momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope for millions of Negroes who were manacled in slavery, right? The shackles of enslavement. And he said, but we are marooned on a tiny island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Wow, this poverty in the midst of all of this wealth, we could say that even today. And then he said, the whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundation of this nation until the Negro, as Black people were then called, is granted his or her citizenship rights. We're gonna be revolting. Now we ain't gonna go to the Capitol and tear stuff up. We're not gonna go there and tear it down. We're not gonna desecrate the holy space of American civic life. You want to ask the people, what y'all mad at? Y'all running stuff. Y'all got stuff in your favor. White privilege, white supremacy, white nationalism, anti-Americanism, anti-democracy. You got most of the good jobs. You got all the presidencies except one. You're running American corporations. What up? It's like, tell them why you're mad, son. It's like the mad rapper. Tell them why you're mad. So he said, the whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundation of this nation until the Negro is granted his or her citizenship rights. And then he said, we have come to the nation's capital to cash a check. The reality is this, that he said, we have come to the nation's capital to cash a check which has been returned to us marked insufficient funds. Ain't got no money in the bank. He said, but I refuse to believe that the great vaults of democracy are empty. That was a Rihanna moment. Nation better have my money. So when we talk about that speech, two things stand out. All right, I'm building up to the two things. First, he talked about the marvelous new militancy that has arisen in the nation. Then he talks about some of us who have come fresh from the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. The marvelous new militancy, he's talking about SNCC, Black Power, that was developing later on with Stokely Carmichael. Black people saying, nope, we got to change the system. We have to challenge the inequality. So he's talking about Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and other revolutionary Black militants, Black Lives Matter of their day. That's all I'm trying to get to, right? Work with me here, people. Dr. King said, now we are talking about Black Lives Matter. Okay, he didn't say that, but I'm just imagining. Then he's talking about the marvelous new militancy. He's speaking about the revolutionary impulse of young Black people, of militants in America, of all races, creeds, and colors who are challenging the system as it is. So for those who try to counterpose Martin Luther King Jr. and Black Lives Matter, it ain't working, son. It's not working. He was down with them. Now, he had disagreements and differences. Some of the beef was when King would show up, he would take the cameras and the spotlight and the media, and SNCC was going, but we did all the work. Or most of it. It's not like King wasn't working. But damn, dog, can we get some love too? Can we get some shine? I mean, whoa. And then plus, you come in, the cameras chase you, and we've done the dirty, nasty, unsexy, everyday work. Voting rights, Freedom Summer of 1963, 64, challenging the dominant white supremacist ethos. We're out here making sure that communities will be created in the image of democracy. Y'all swoop in with Dr. King, give a speech. Everybody says, oh, he's the bum. And we've been doing the work. Then they called him the Lord, or the Lord behind his back. You know how young people do, be trying to crack on us old people. You know what it is. And then they laughed at him because he liked to wear silk pajamas. What you mad at, son? He wanted a little leisure at the crib. He's out here giving his life. He's going to jail in Birmingham. He's out there getting threatened every day. Can a man wear some silk pajamas? Come on, young people. So Black Lives Matter of its day, SNCC, he valorized, he valued, he uplifted, he elevated the work of militants of Black Lives Matter, of SNCC, of African-American, Latinx, indigenous young people of color who had been radicalized by the white supremacist ethos of American culture that denied the legitimacy of our humanity. That's number one. So what would he be doing today? Standing with Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, and the rest of Black Lives Matter. He would be standing on the front line with those who say we've got to call an end to social inequity and inequality and injustice. That's one. Number two, the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. He was talking about it in 63. We're talking about it in 2021. We saw George Floyd. No excuses for white people. That's why many white brothers and sisters got involved with the movement. All the asterisks were removed. All the excuses gone. Well, he must have been menacing to you. He's on the ground, prostrate, with three cops, one on his neck, one on his back, one on his legs. Oh, okay. He must have been wielding a gun. Okay. He ain't got nothing. He can't even lift himself. He can't even breathe. He must have been nasty to the police. Officer, please, sir. Does that sound nasty to you? When you're losing your life and you still have the home training to treat these police people with respect, the respect they are not treating you. And it was a multicultural lineup. Don't get it twisted. The white cop on his neck, the black cop on his back, another white cop on his legs, and the Asian cop is the lookout. Multiculturalism ain't enough. Multiculturalism with justice is the point, right? You can have a multicultural lineup, but y'all could all be homophobic. You can have a multicultural lineup, but y'all could be all anti-Black, all anti-Indigenous. Just because you a different color don't mean you a different kind, a different content of your political and ideological commitment to social transformation. And so Dr. King saw that this was a problem. White brothers and sisters said, all the excuses are gone. They hit the street. The protests swelled to the largest ever in the history of this nation because white brothers and sisters, for the first time, some of them fell in love with black people. Right? There's no judgment. I'm just saying. That's just what it is. They finally got it. It clicked. Like, oh, damn, this is what they're talking about. Because I always thought, Jiminy Cricket, you must have said something. You must have cursed him out. This dude is sitting here begging for his life and doing nothing of harm to anybody, and you still killed him. White folks said, can't do it. They hit the streets. It's all quiet now. Now, I don't know about y'all, and I'm going to end on this point. When you fall in love, you know, when you first fall in love, oh, hey, how are you? Oh, I love you. I love you, too. You know, let me take you roller skating. Let me take you to play tiddlywinks. Let me take you to play bingo at the Catholic church. I got a low budget here. I'm a student, man. What you want from me? All right. Let me buy you some ramen noodles and let's sit up here and watch, you know, Netflix all night. Oh, it's love. All right. Let's watch Bridgerton together. Yes. And then 6 months later, did you leave the toilet seat up? Because I almost fell in it, son. What are you doing, man? Come on now. You know, as a woman, what's up with that? Don't do that. Are you actually rolling the toothpaste from the top and not the bottom? What? Are you a barbarian? Come on. But then, even though you've gone from the in love part to the everyday part, it's the unsexy everyday that tests the durability of your affection. Right? So now, who's taking the kids to school? Right? Who's taking daddy duty and mommy duty? Who's changing the diaper at 3 o'clock in the morning when the baby is crying? Who's going to take the kids to sports? Who's going to get up? In other words, the unsexy stuff, the everyday normal stuff, is where you test the durability of your commitment. And that's where we are. Black Lives Matter, police brutality, two things anticipated by Dr. King that he would be deeply involved with in this moment. And as I end this little part and we'll have conversation, it's extremely important for all of us. Got a new president. I don't know how you feel about that. I know this is not political, so I'm going to just leave that alone. But hallelujah. Okay. Good morning. Damn. You know, even the Republicans were going, get this dude out of here, please. Even Mitch McConnell was like, president, come on, rolls out. And in elegant fashion, really rose up against an anti-democratic fashion and ginned up the white supremacists. Mitch McConnell? Dude, you must be messing up. Mitch McConnell coming at your neck. But don't get it twisted. White supremacy reinforced by the vicious elements of what we saw in the Capitol and by the Mitch McConnells and the Ted Cruz's and the Marco Rubio's and the Josh Hawley's and all these Congress people who are feeding and stoking conspiracy theory, knowing damn well that was a true election, knowing damn well that you are ginning up the conservative reactionary right-wing forces that live on a diet of conspiracy and anti-statism that you as a representative of the state should be ashamed for stoking. So in this day and age, let's continue to hold high the bloodstained banner of truth. Because people of color are the ones who died for this nation without recognition. And those white folk, for the most part, who were mad the other day, going to the Capitol and tearing up, that would be more easily understood if it was us. What we have not been given, what we have been denied, but we still love this country. We are loyal to this country, even though we believe you got to be criticized. James Baldwin said, I love America more than any other nation on earth. That's why I reserve the right to perpetually criticize. So as I end, Dr. King would be involved with Black Lives Matter. Dr. King would be involved in defunding the police, challenging the hegemony of the police, asking why it is that the police have the kind of funds they do, at least thinking about it, to change the system. I'll end right there. and have our conversation with my wonderful young friends.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dyson, for your powerful words. I know that I'm not the only one who was shaking my head and snapping my fingers saying, I know that's right. But to preface my first question, you've done a lot of work surrounding toxic masculinities and asking male identifying persons to examine harmful practices and paradigms. As you have said before, you know, our most recent political upheaval puts these very issues, you know, into sharp focus. So my question is, could you share your observations on how patriarchy and toxic masculinity, especially within our own communities, are obscuring the conversations we need to be having?
Yeah, I mean, the vicious, bitter assault upon women, upon American democracy are not as in opposition as one might think. They're more intertwined than we know. At the beginning of this nation, women couldn't even vote. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. That's toxic masculinity in some fancy language. That's racism in some fancy language. In other words, women need not apply. Black people, we ain't even thinking about you. So it's toxic, but it's nice. It's refined. It's elegant. But it's still bitter and it's still poisonous. And so what we have to do is to look not at simply at rap music, though rap music is chock full of toxic masculinity, right? Still to this day, even though we love it and we appreciate what it's done, we have to be critical of the funkiness, the foul elements, the nefarious insistence on demonizing women. But then again, the church does too. It's more slick. You know, it says, well, the Lord doesn't want you to step up on the pulpit. You have to give announcements from the floor. That's toxic masculinity. We just ain't called it that, but that's what it is. So we have to look at patriarchy's paradigms, its poisonous practices, its toxic iterations, and say we have to challenge that. We have to challenge the unconscious reflex toward male supremacy. We have to challenge the dominance of masculinist ideas where we continue to reproduce the pathology of misogyny, of sexism, of patriarchy, and of femophobia, right? Phobic at the presence of real women. And when we do that, we embrace greater avenues of healing. When we work in concert with women, and challenging our own toxic internal masculinity and some women who smuggle in toxic masculinity within their female form. I'm just saying now, Toxic masculinity is not the ultimate or exclusive preserve of men. Women who internalize limitations on their gender have smuggled in toxic masculinity through ventriloquism. Women's mouth moving, toxic masculine ideas floating. Now, often this comes, I don't want to just blame it on one side, but the right-wing conservative values of certain women that reproduce the pathology of white supremacist patriarchal culture, as, you know, bell hooks would speak about it. So we have to identify it, we have to acknowledge it, and we have to resist it. Or like my man, you know, Liam Neeson said, you know, I'll identify it, I'm gonna hunt you down, and then I'm gonna kill it. So that's what we gotta do to toxic masculinity as well.
Thanks so much for addressing that. I really love that you brought up this idea of an unconscious reflex toward misogyny. And that's actually related to my question as well. So we talk a lot about things white individuals can do to help counter white privilege and address white supremacy. And there's been this ongoing call for anti-racist self-education for these people wanting to start making a difference. But I'm curious if you could speak to the Black and BIPOC individuals in the room about how we can personally overcome that pervasive negative effect of white supremacy in our own lives. You say in Making Malcolm, you write the internal struggles for a liberated consciousness. And so I also appreciate that you ground this conversation of racial equity, which can sometimes be abstract. So you offer practical and accessible suggestions for change. So I'd like to know what you believe are concrete ways we can decondition and decolonize our own minds, hearts, and bodies as Black students and humans of color, but also as Americans.
Malcolm X was a genius at that, trying to figure out how the white man is occupying our mindsets, influencing us, shaping us, and really dictating the terms of our self-assessment. Du Bois said it must be a strange thing in 1903 to measure yourself against the judgment of another world, constantly seeing yourself through the prism of a dominant white supremacist culture that ain't got no love for you. So read some Malcolm, read some Dr. King at the end when he talked about signing, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation of your own Black identity. He called it manhood, Olympian manhood, but we can get beyond manhood to talk about personhood. Or read some Frantz Fanon, Black Skin. I mean, was it Black Skin, White Mask, or White Skin? Black Skin, White Mask, or, and so, you know, the way in which we put on as a kind of racial minstrelsy, whiteness, to further our goals and objectives, to think better about ourselves, believing the white water is wetter, white ideas are brighter, white culture is better, more refined, right? We've been taught this from the get-go. So we have to deprogram, decolonize, de-establish the hegemony, the dominance of white supremacist ideas about who we are that pervert us, that poison us, that contaminate our self-awareness and self-consciousness. And so we read, we think, we talk to other people, we begin to purge this stuff. It ain't no once and done kind of thing. It's a constant lifelong process because you're subject to this over the span of your life. Constantly being seduced by beliefs and ideas that are extraneous to your culture in a negative fashion. I'm not saying that all ideas extraneous to your culture are bad. I'm just saying the ones that teach you to hate yourself, that don't like yourself, that don't appreciate yourself, that don't appreciate your culture, that you don't do business with people of your kind, say even Black people, you know, about them N-words, you know, they don't never take care of business. That doesn't mean that some Black people don't fail at business, but then go to the next Black person. Because when white folk fail, you ain't done with white folk. Oh, this school, you know, messed up. I'm going to transfer to another. You don't say I'm done with white schools, right? So give us the benefit of the doubt. Understand the way in which we've been taught to disavow the legitimacy of our kind and to become complicit in our own demise. And the self-hatred that manifests itself with the inability to embrace and love Blackness. Black love is a revolutionary act in a white supremacist culture. Self-love and self-care are revolutionary tools of Black self-affirmation in a white supremacist culture. And so that's what we have to do in concrete measure. Go to Black Sunday schools, go to Black institutions that teach this, go to Black organizations that remind you. I'm talking about practical stuff you can do. Read Black books that talk about this. Just Black it up for a minute so you can understand the complicated nuances of your Blackness amidst a culture that teaches you to despise yourself.
You're listening to Michael Eric Dyson on Chaos or Community. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and Angela Davis's book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. 444-1977.
So many students of the world minority who are embedded in these predominantly white structures, such as institutions of higher education like Metropolitan State University, the University of Colorado Denver, University of Colorado Boulder, are strategizing with white allies or are just bravely holding up mirrors to the white supremacist cultures and practices. So in your own education and career, what strategies did you use to advocate for yourself and your scholarship?
Yes, a great point. I mean, I remember giving a keynote speech in 1993, and there were three people at this big conference that got standing ovations. Stuart Hall, who was then probably arguably still the greatest Black intellectual in Western speaking cultures. Toni Morrison, writer, Nobel Prize laureate. She, I don't think she was that by then. Extraordinary writer and figure. And then me. It's not a humble brag, but the reason I'm saying I got a standing ovation is because despite some hate, because at that point when I was quoting hip hop, people were like, why are you doing that? 90s Snoopy Doggy Dog. I can't believe it. You have a PhD from Princeton and you're frigging quoting Snoop, falling back on that ass with a hellified gangsterly, getting funky on the mic like an old batch of collard greens. It's the capital. Oh, yes, I'm fresh in double B, D-O-double-G-Y-D-O-W-G-U-C. Like they were picture, like, what? But despite the hate, I got to stand and ovate. I do it like I do. Okay, anyway, I don't freestyle on y'all. So the thing is, that I done paid a price. People dogging me, taught hip hop, pop culture at places. Why are you teaching them about Jay-Z and Nas and Tupac Shakur, right? Tupac. Because Tupac said, just the other day, I got lynched by some crooked cops. And to this day, them same cops on the beat getting major pay. But when I get my check, they taking tax out. So we paying the cops to knock the blacks out. That's why I'm teaching Tupac. Because Jay-Z said, Al-Qaeda, what did he say? Bin Laden been happening in Manhattan. Back then, back when police was Al-Qaeda to black men. So I still teach Beyonce, stay gracious, best revenge, get your paper, right? So the thing is, right, build up enough capital so you have an infrastructure of institutional independence and autonomy so you can tell people to kiss your ass in a progressive fashion. You can dress up like a Black Panther at the Super Bowl. You do what you do. And so, you know, it was a rough way for me to, you know, hold, so to speak, because people hating, people dogging, but I kept stepping. I kept trying to challenge the dominant mindset, the paradigm that said Black people shouldn't, scholars shouldn't, you shouldn't do the hip hop, you shouldn't do the pop culture, you shouldn't do that, right? All the ways they're trying to crack on me and dismiss me and disavow what I do, got to keep going. And in my own career, if you were asking me the question about me personally, having to grapple with these narrow, negative, nefarious, problematic ways of seeing myself, and it was all along that spectrum, and people trying to hurt and dismiss me and trying to suggest that I was illegitimate and inauthentic, but I studied French and German too. I did all the stuff the rest of y'all doing. Das ist verboten, ich bin ein Berliner, ein Feste Buches unter Gott. I did that. I did the French. Ce n'est pas difficile d'apprendre français, c'est facile. I'm doing all that. I'm spitting them lyrics at y'all. Sounding like I'm Busta Rhymes. And then I'm doing the vernacular. Gizzo to the stizzo, rizzite nizza, brizzother. Halala at your bizzo at rizzite nizza. I can do that too. So I can do those ghetto linguistics. I can do the highfalutin gravitas of the culture, because that's what I do. So the thing is that by learning to accept myself and hopefully the beauty and the importance of what I do, the gifts God gave me, the talents I developed, was extremely important for me to be able to say what I have to say, to talk what I have to talk, and to do what I have to do without excuse or apology. So that's kind of how I did.
And Beyonce also says, I just wanted to quote this now that you're throwing out lyrics. She says, life is your birthright. They hid that in the fine print. Take the pen and rewrite it. And that's like you writing your own narrative and being authentic in yourself. Love it. So my fourth final question here. I wanted to know, you kind of already mentioned this, but I wanted to give you some space to go off a little. Can you talk about the dichotomy between the treatment of the Black Lives Matter protesters versus the mostly white insurrectionist treatment at the Capitol building that happened?
Yeah, I'm glad you qualified it as mostly white, because people are going to say, well, there were some Latinx people, some Black people. We said mostly, dog. And don't act like Black and brown people can't be white supremacists. That's the whole point. That's the whole point. It can migrate into your brain, into your mindset. You can be the most effective patriarch as a woman with a skirt. You can be the greatest white supremacist in brown skin. So please, you know, but we know how ugly that was. And we know if that had been Black Lives Matter trying to get up into the Capitol, been dead Black people, a bunch of them. God rest the soul of that white woman who died. Even though I disagreed vigorously and vehemently with her viewpoints, I don't think they should have shot her. But then they felt that their lives were under threat too, right? When they always say that about us, we saw the woman coming through the darn window. Now they're gonna put that dude who shot her on suspension. And you can best believe killing a white woman, they're gonna treat him like, unless you just really have to do that, dog, we ain't down with that. Even a white insurrectionist. Insurrectionists, undermining government, disloyal to the nation, Confederate flag, the very bloodstained banner of disloyalty, of secession, of leaving the nation, of saying, y'all, and we're out. And the most holy, sacred, revered ground in civic social space in America, during one of the greatest rituals of democracy, counting the votes, the accounting for the Electoral College votes, and y'all trying to interrupt that on the notion that it was illegitimate, and you ain't got no damn proof. And these senators who know better, that's why they're white supremacists too. You just an easier, slicker, Ivy League version of white supremacy. But we see you and we know what you're doing. And so the truth is that had that been Black Lives Matter protesters, even Joe Biden had to recognize that. Because his granddaughter hit him up and said, Papa, you know that had that been Black Lives Matter protesters, they would have not been treated the same way. So it's good to be president and have a granddaughter who's woke. Thank you, granddaughter. And so we know the disavowal of Black identity, the desecration of Blackness, the hatred of who we are, of indigenous identities, of red, yellow, brown identities in this country, of First Nation identities in this country, of Native peoples, we would have been eviscerated, tore up, shot, killed, arrested. How do we know? When we had Black Lives Matter protests, they treated them like they were insurrectionists. So they need to do a switch up. You know, on Freaky Friday, you get into one body and the other body get into yours. The old person comes to the young person go to the old person. Let's have some Freaky Friday up in here where the Black Lives Matter protest police get into the state the Capitol Police, and the Capitol Police jump into the bodies of the Black Lives Matter protests. I think I came up with a hell of an idea there. Because we know that the refusal to acknowledge the humanity of Black people is a persistent theme in American society. And the refusal to acknowledge our humanity is the predicate of American democracy for so many people. So they were being honest and explicit and transparent about the often masked and hidden beliefs and premises of American democracy. That's why American exceptionalism is white supremacy on the sly. Claiming America's better than other nations. How? We look like a banana republic the other day. We don't agree with you. We're going to tear this down. Despite no evidence, no empirical verification of their beliefs. And so we have to constantly call attention to white brothers and sisters in particular and to the dominant culture about the egregious failure to understand the differential treatment accorded to those mostly white folk on the mall and Black people whose only cry is to be free, who ain't tearing nothing up, who ain't shooting nobody, who ain't beating up and destroying no buildings. And in the Black Lives Matter protests, when they did, it was largely Antifa. I ain't trying to demonize them. Go for what you know, but I'm saying most Negroes weren't even doing that. In fact, they saw them, they were like, hey, stop, because they're going to blame us for all this. Stop. So not that I'm denying the legitimacy of allies. I'm just saying that ain't Black people's stilo. And so we have to acknowledge that and to acknowledge the egregious inequality that exists in this country when we treat protesters versus insurrectionists, versus mobs, versus the militants on the mall who wanted to eradicate American democracy. The difference is Black Lives Matter protesters are trying to make democracy better. And the mob was trying to undercut democracy and destroy it altogether. That's what we got to remember when we look at the two.
We're going to move into some audience questions now. So we won't be able to get to all of them, but I'm going to start with one. So she's asking, Dr. King posed the question, where do we go from here, chaos or community? So how do we start to think about this again?
Great point. Black Lives Matter, community. White supremacists on the mall, chaos. Where do we go from here? Chaos, challenging the legitimacy of democracy, or Black Lives Matter, community, trying to forge connection between all concerned citizens to radically reorient the government back to its original purposes as articulated by the founding fathers. Chaos, white supremacy, community, love of all peoples. That's how we make a start.
So the next question is from Boulder. And it says, David Foster Wallace once wrote that anything I've ever let go of still has my claw marks on it. We keep hearing about the so many Americans that are clinging to a mythical past. Which aspects of America's mythological past are you having a hard time letting go of?
That's a brilliant point. Y'all killing the game over here, man. Y'all killing the game. Both of those questions, so smart. You know, I'm having a hard time letting go of the fact that America is a real democracy. Call me ignorant, naive. I truly believe that at the end of the day, we can make a difference. I truly believe that at the end of the day, that the notion that America is an experiment worthy of undertaking, I'm still there. I still believe that America can become the best that it should be, not make America great again. Make it the best it can be. Make it good. I don't know if good again. Make it good. Make it important. Make it relevant. Make it just. Make it useful to the masses of citizens. So the claw marks of David Foster Wallace that I let go that still have their marks on me is the belief that at the end of the day, we can be truly e pluribus unum, out of many, one. But we can't have unity without justice. Unity is the bridge. Justice is the destination. Let's be unified for an edifying purpose. Not unity for its own sake, but unity for transformation. That's what I'd say.
This next question is asked, there's an increased talk surrounding white fear and white fragility, but how do Black people grapple with Black fear?
Yeah. Why are you scared? Are you scared? I mean, there's a reason to be fearful. People killing you, people dogging you, people trying to undercut you, people suggesting that you are not truly American, people threatening your life, people saying that they're going to murder you if you show up at a protest movement, people trying to harm and harass you. There's a reason that Black people are fearful. Let's not, that ain't no parallel between white fragility and white fear of and white comfort and Black fear. Those them things are totally different. I mean, there should be some overlap, of course, philosophically speaking, within certain privileged communities whose Black fragility, if we could call it, is in relationship to mostly other Black people. But when it comes to, you know, like richer people being told by poorer people about their position and they can't hear it and they don't want to talk about it, or people of privilege and wealth not wanting to hear their accountability to the masses, right? So we got our Black fragility too in that sense. But in comparative analysis with white folk, it's a different story. Having said that, we've got to overcome that fear. We've got to overcome the horrors of the threats and the harassment and reclaim a kind of internal courage and intestinal fortitude that allows us to keep moving forward. And that's why you get on calls like this, you talk to your people, you join clubs, you reinforce each other so that you can, at your weakest moment, be elevated by your peers who can remind you of what you're made of and what you can do.
This next question is coming from a white ally saying, I'm struggling to have conversations with my family about racist behaviors they display. When I bring those behaviors up, they say I'm not racist. I don't hate Black people, but it's the microaggressions. They can't seem to see their All Lives Matter BS. That they can't see as problematic. Do you have any advice on how to break the defense barrier in a dialogue with people you love?
Yeah, no, that's a great question too. You know, I'm glad you raised that, because as difficult as it is for you, imagine that as a Black person, we're trying to reach some of your family members who are lovely and wonderful, but who are recalcitrant and arthritic, refusing to acknowledge. I love Black people. I love Beyonce and Jay-Z and love the Harlem Globetrotters and love the Golden State Warriors, and that Steph Curry is a great, you know. But then the microaggressions, as you said, brave point that the questioner has raised. So, but as difficult as it is for us, as it is for you, it's probably more difficult for us because we can't even be heard. So we want to deputize you to go up into your family, as tough as it is. When you go home for Thanksgiving, they eat your pumpkin pie first. Because I was going to say sweet potato, but you know what I'm saying? That's Black, you know, that's what we do. Eat your stuffing first. We call it dressing. But whatever. Get your macaroni and cheese on first. Then challenge granny, cousins, uncles, peers, younger people. It ain't just old people. The people on the mall, a lot of them were young. People in Charlottesville, anti-Semites, they're young. So one of the things you do is you ask them, how would you feel if? Try to how would you feel ifs with your white folk? How would you feel if somebody was treating you the same way? How would you feel if that was your granddaughter who was being spoken of and you were, your child had married interracially? And now you got a granddaughter who's seen as one of them, somebody you love. How would you feel if? Just try some of them, how would you feel ifs? Then secondly, do the, you know, if it was Black people, it, right? On the mall, how they be treated versus Black Lives Matter that we've talked about earlier. And you can give them comparative analyses and then go, you know better than that because, right? And the you know better than that because is, you know, Uncle Bubba is a dumb ass white boy, but you see all the good stuff he be getting. He got into college. You know he is illiterate, but a smart Black person had to be in competition with him. And because of anti-affirmative action, they felt that Uncle Bubba deserved to break over that Black person. So when you begin to point out some of the internal contradictions in whiteness, and say, you know, when you say you love Black people, but that, you know, you come up with the microaggressions, how much love do you really have? And you ask them, how much concern with that people do you really exhibit? And how can you say that you're for fairness and justice and equality when you know these inequities exist? So you got to kind of wear them down. It's hard. It's difficult. It's people you love. You can't throw them away. I don't believe in that cancel culture. I believe in holding people accountable. I don't believe in canceling nobody. First of all, you can't cancel nobody. It's even like what David Foster Wallace said with the earlier quote, you still got your claws in you, the stuff that you let go. So, you know, yes, hold people accountable. Yes, impose constraints. But at the end of the day, white supremacy is, I mean, cancel culture is white supremacy by other means. Because Black people at our best ain't trying to cancel you. We're trying to convert you. We're trying to transform you. But just because you disagree with somebody, what about if they cancel you now at 17 and you become conscious at 34? What, are they going to uncancel you? How about not cancel me at the start? Why don't you just work with me? Give me a sense of who I am. Or if I mess up, are you going to cancel me because I messed up one time? Really? All the stuff I've done for 50 years, you just, oh, you don't, you're done. Come on. That's a white supremacist idea. We're smuggling in white supremacy. When we were talking earlier about how do we combat internal dimensions of white supremacy, cancel culture is one of them. I know a lot of young people don't want to hear that. I know y'all mad, like you was preaching until now. Negro, you tripping now. Yeah, just hear me. Cancel culture operates by the same principle that dominant white supremacy operates. Zero tolerance is not a principle of Black people. If that's the case, we'd cancel every white person in America. Why do you think your older Black people voted for Joe Biden? I know younger people might have had some problems. The reason they voted for him? You're telling me a white boy was mad at busing? Where you been, son? A lot of them are. But lately, he was working with this Black president, trying to work stuff out, and he showed his loyalty. Yes, he did the crime bill. That was horrible and horrendous. But a lot of Black ministers and a lot of Black politicians were on that crime bill too. So stop being disingenuous. Don't cancel, convert, cajole, resist, engage, criticize. But cancel? No, no. So when you talk to you, we're going to deputize you as a white ally to challenge white supremacy from within and to hold your people accountable even as you try to love the hell up out of them. Thank y'all so much. We've got a great honor. Love y'all. Keep up the good work.
You were just listening to Michael Eric Dyson, Chaos or Community. He spoke in Nashville on January 22nd, 2021. Michael Eric Dyson is an internationally renowned scholar of race, religion, and contemporary culture. He's the Centennial Chair and University Distinguished Professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, Kianga Yamata Taylor, Tariq Ali, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. We also have a series of programs featuring Michael Eric Dyson. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Michael Eric Dyson, Chaos or Community, and for Angela Davis's book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with these sacred souls. Give us justice.
Could have been me. Could have been me. Until there's justice, until there's justice.